twin attacks in the heart of Europe. Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Dozens of people killed by multiple explosions today in Brussels, including two blasts at the city's international airport.
We were running over the debris from the ceiling and broken glass from where the windows had exploded. I think there were one or two people lying injured as well.
The Islamic State has claimed responsibility.
By attacking the capital of the European Union, they are striking at the heart of Europe.
Also, President Obama concludes his visit to Cuba. In a speech to the Cuban people, he says he went to Havana to bury the last remnants of the Cold War.
I think that's as close as we got to a Reagan-esque tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev moment.
Those stories ahead, right here on The World. We were planning to focus mostly on Cuba today and the final day of President Obama's historic visit to Havana. We'll have some stories on that still later in the show, but we begin with the latest on the attacks in Brussels. The Belgian capital is on maximum alert following multiple explosions in two places, the international airport and a subway station. Dozens of people were killed and hundreds injured. Belgian authorities say the blasts were acts of terrorism, and ISIS has claimed responsibility. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Anna Holligan. She's part of the BBC team covering the aftermath in Brussels.
We're right outside the European Commission building, right in the heart of Brussels, where the flags are flying half-mast. This is very close to the scene of the explosion at the Maalbeek metro station, where at least 20 people were killed. We've actually just got in the car because we're on the way to another district of Brussels, Schaarbeek. This is, we're hearing reports, the scene of another police operation. This, we should say, is the place where the brother of Salah Abdeslam, who was arrested last week, was buried last week. He was one of the people involved in the Paris terror attacks. And we've just heard from the authorities here in Belgium that they are not yet linking the attacks in Brussels today with the attacks in Paris last November. But certainly people are feeling, after this statement from the so-called Islamic State claiming responsibility, that it has shown once again their ability to strike fear in the heart of Europe.
What's the mood of the people in Brussels right now?
People who we've spoken to are defiant. They are determined to continue with their lives and refuse to allow the aims of the terrorists to stop them from going about their business. People, you can hear the cars driving past, taxi there, are leaving their office buildings right now. Earlier today, schools were closed, according to the crisis centre which has been set up. A couple of metro stations have reopened. The main train stations have reopened, although the airport where the explosions went off this morning will be closed again tomorrow, and Belgium is holding 3 days of national warning. And also the terror threat level has been raised to 4, which is the highest level. And we heard from the Belgian Prime Minister earlier today. He said this was a tragic moment in our country's history, but what we feared has happened. So there is very much a sense amongst the people here that an attack might have been imminent. And then there is the question of why the intelligence services were unable to prevent this.
What is the latest on why these bombings took place now?
Why these bombings took place now is a question that the security services, the politicians, the people here on the streets of Brussels will all be asking themselves. At the moment, no one has the answer. There has been speculation today that the timing is significant insofar as it comes 4 days after the arrest of 26-year-old Salah Abdeslam. He was one of the main suspects in the Paris attacks. He was apprehended on a street close to his home in the Molenbeek district of Brussels last Friday. The speculation is that these attacks were conducted in retaliation against that operation, or perhaps because his associates feared that he may surrender to the authorities, because we heard from his lawyer over the weekend that he was cooperating with the Belgian police during the interrogations. But of course, as the Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel said today, what we feared, their worst fears have been confirmed, which is why they are now dealing with more than 30 casualties after these three, it seems, coordinated explosions in Brussels.
My BBC colleague Anna Holligan in Brussels. Belgium's closest allies offered words of condolence and pledges of support today. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
Speaking in Havana, Cuba this morning, President Obama responded to the news from Brussels. Obama said the United States will do whatever is necessary to help Belgium bring those responsible to justice.
And this is yet another reminder that the world must unite. We must be together, regardless of nationality or race or faith, in fighting against the scourge of terrorism. We can and we will defeat those who threaten the safety and security of people all around the world.
Leaders of the European Union released a statement today. They said the Brussels attacks were aimed at the EU's open democratic society. British Prime Minister David Cameron said the kind of attacks that took place in Belgium today could very well have happened in Britain, France, or Germany. Cameron said British security and police forces are stepping up their presence at ports, airports, and train stations.
These are difficult times. These are appalling terrorists, but we must stand together to do everything we can to stop them and to make sure that although they attack our way of life and they attack us because of who we are, we will never let them win.
In Paris, officials planned to light up the Eiffel Tower in the colors of the Belgian flag, black, yellow, and red. The French Interior Ministry said it would deploy 1,600 additional police and security forces around the country, and President Francois Hollande repeated something he said after the Paris attacks in November. Europe is at war, he said through an interpreter.
This war against terrorism should be taken in a calm and lucid and determined way, because it will be a long war.
Today's deadly attacks raise difficult questions for the European Union about its open border policies, about immigration, about policing and intelligence sharing. But even before the explosions in Brussels this morning, security experts had warned that Belgium's counterterrorism efforts were lacking. But Belgian parliamentarian Georges-Louis Boucher told the BBC it would be wrong to blame his country's security services for what happened today.
There is a lot of Belgium bashing that is not a reality. We work hard and it's not easy for my country because we are in the center of Europe and there is a lot of movement between the different countries, but the police make the maximum for the security.
Boucher said the best response is to strike a balance between security and freedom.
It's possible to control a lot of things. It's not possible to control everything every time. The only solution is to leave democracy, but it's not a choice for us. So it's important to be more vigilant, but it's not possible to stop leaving and to stop the democracy.
This afternoon, ISIS appeared to claim responsibility for the attacks in Brussels. In an online statement, the group said the Belgian capital was carefully selected, and it warned of more such attacks against the, quote, crusader states allied against it. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Matt Levitt is a former intelligence official with the FBI and the Treasury. He's now director of the counterterrorism program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Matt Levitt, you were just in Brussels meeting with counterterrorism officials there last week. Did they seem concerned at all about the possibility of an attack?
They did indeed. They were very concerned and they were eager to tell me all the things that they've been putting in place recently since the November attacks in Paris and even before them. But they were also, to their credit, I think, pretty open about how far they have yet to go. And I think it's a lesson for all of us. Belgium is not alone in trying to do the right thing and still having a ways to go to be able to contend with a very serious threat. But the fact is that Belgium in particular is a very federal government. There are multiple parliaments across geography, across language, across ethnicity. You don't always have the most smooth communication between local police departments. Their ability to share intelligence within the Belgium system isn't perfect yet. And they're part of the European Union, within and across the European Union. The ability to share information is still a work in progress. And the second thing is staffing levels. You know, one of the critical neighborhoods in Belgium is Molenbeek, which is just three or four metro stops from the city center, and which has become part of almost every counterterrorism investigation they've had. Salah Abdeslam, the last fugitive from the Paris attacks who was captured on Friday, was captured in the neighborhood he grew up in Molenbeek. And there, they're down 185 police officers.
You mentioned the arrest of Salah Abdeslam, the last live suspect in the Paris attacks. Do you see any connection between these attacks today and him, whether as a reaction to his arrest or as something he may have been involved in planning?
Look, it's really too early to tell definitively one way or the other, but there are certain things that authorities are going to be looking at very closely. One is we know that there is a larger support network for Abdeslam and other Islamic State operatives in Europe in general and Belgium in particular than originally anticipated. Just look at how long Salah Abdeslam was able to hide out in Belgium since the attacks in Paris in November. And they've been talking about this quite openly for the past few weeks, about their concern about these networks being larger than they had anticipated, A. B, it's been widely reported in the press since Friday that Abdeslam is talking to authorities. Even if that's not the case, the fact that it's been reported is such, if I were a member of either his or another Islamic State network in Belgium and I were planning some type of attack, I would probably move up my attack planning for fear that he might say something that would be incriminating or lead authorities to me or to undermine my plot. And so it's entirely possible this is something completely different. It's entirely possible that there is a connection between either this network or different networks. And it's entirely possible that they are not known to each other, but they just decided to move up their operational planning because Abdeslam was captured and is reported as talking.
You mentioned the challenges for Belgium in coordinating intelligence and de-radicalization programs and knowing how many people at risk they have. What about European officials at large? Is Europe as a whole coordinating enough to combat terrorism?
Europe as a whole is doing better, but it has a very long way to go. I met with the EU Counterterrorism Coordinator's Office. They just had released their latest report to the Council of the European Union, and maybe the biggest takeaway from the report is that intelligence sharing isn't happening yet as much as it should. When it comes to reports of foreign terrorist fighters, they only are at about 50% of what we know to be true. And those reports are coming from only 5 of the European Union member states. They talked about the need to do much more to share border crossing information, to put in place biometric information. The ability of some of these European, Belgian and French Islamic State operatives in particular, to come and go almost at will, sometimes hiding within migrant flows, sometimes not, to come into Europe, to go back, to be able to coordinate things from different parts of Europe. This is something that really has to be a focus of concern. The ability to travel freely within Europe is a very powerful economic tool. It's not a bad thing, but from a counterterrorism perspective, it certainly is a vulnerability. Not saying that we should stop this open border system, but it does mean that we do need to do more wherever the border starts to collect information on people who are coming and going and then immediately share that information with everybody else.
Matt Levitt, why are these kinds of attacks so common in Europe but not here in the States?
One of the reasons is that Europe is literally at the Islamic State's doorstep, or the Islamic State is at Europe's doorstep. This is not something that's happening in Chechnya is contained there, or happening in Afghanistan and is contained there. The ability to travel, it's inexpensive, it's quick, from Iraq and Syria through Turkey into Europe. The fact that they've been able to have small numbers of individuals hide within refugee and migrant communities means that this is something that is affecting Europe in an immediate way.
Matt Levitt is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
After today's attacks in Brussels, President Obama called Belgium's prime minister to offer American support. The president made the call from Havana on the last day of his visit there. The latest on Obama in Cuba is just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Another historic scene today in Havana. The presidents of the United States and Cuba sitting side by side, chatting at a baseball game. And it was just one of the highlights of President Obama's last day in Havana. Earlier, the president addressed the Cuban people in a televised speech. Tom Hudson was listening. He's a special correspondent for WLRN in Miami, and he's in Havana right now.
President Obama looked directly at the audience in Gran Teatro in Old Havana, but also spoke directly to the Cubans on the island here, saying that he has come here to Cuba to, quote, bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I think that's as close as we got to a Reagan-esque tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, moment in this speech today to the Cuban people.
And how did the audience, the live audience, react in the theater?
I think there were three audiences that the president was speaking to today from Havana. One was the Cuban people, not only inside this Baroque grand theater in Old Havana, but also Cuban people spread across the island. I think the second audience was in the balcony. It was Raul Castro and the Cuban government, the revolutionary government that he and his brother led and he represents. And thirdly, it was Cuban Americans in South Florida and Cuban Americans throughout the country back home in the United States, acknowledging the pain and the emotional suffering and the familial separation of the past half century.
What about the issue of human rights and political dissidents? What did Obama say about that?
President Obama acknowledged that there were significant differences that remain between the United States policy and the Cuban policy. He spoke about human rights. He spoke about how President Castro has spoken at length with President Obama about the Castro view of human rights and where the Castro regime thinks that the United States human rights come up short, namely the death penalty and racial tensions that remain in U.S. society.
And of course, yesterday, Raul Castro got a dig in at that press conference about what he termed human rights, which is health care, education guaranteed and free, which the U.S. doesn't have. So he seemed to sort of punch back a bit.
In his speech today, President Obama also acknowledged some accolades for the Cuban government, especially in regards to health care. He spoke about Cuban doctors traveling across the world to help ease pain and suffering, and that also received a friendly applause in the theater here in Havana.
Has President Obama literally been able to walk around Havana and shake people's hands and get up close, or is he more controlled?
He was able to eat in a Paladar, a privately owned restaurant in Old Havana, where he did encounter certainly waiters and waitresses and spoke to the restaurant staff and ownership. And he has been able to work a rope line here or there. But generally speaking, it has been a fairly controlled environment for the president thus far in Havana.
Tom, President Obama's visit to Cuba, of course, will be capped off with this baseball game. Is that a real high point for many of the Cubans there?
Certainly. It's an acknowledgement of what the president spoke about in his speech today to the Cuban people of this shared history, shared interest in what the president hopes is a shared future together. And there is no more concrete expression of that than the president of the United States in the grandstand with Tampa Bay Rays, a Major League Baseball team, against the Cuban national team at a stadium in Havana, Cuba.
Tom Hudson, special correspondent for WLRN in Miami. He's been in Havana for President Obama's visit. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Carol. Nice to be with you.
Miami is the hub of the Cuban-American community. By contrast, San Diego is about as far as you can get from the island. My colleague Marco Werman is there, as you've been hearing in recent days. He's been working out of the studios of station KPBS. Not many Cubans in San Diego, but Marco did manage to find a spot where Cubans in the area gather. It's called Andre's Restaurant. Marco sat down for a chat with owner Daniel Mara, whose family left Cuba before the revolution.
So when politics came up in your family here in San Diego, what was the discussion like?
Well, I have to give a little bit of a background. My father was a very strong hardliner against communism. So that's how I was brought up. Like, for example, none of the brothers or the sisters have gone to Cuba because it was indoctrinated in us that going to Cuba is supporting communism. So, and my father fought against communism. My dad was in the Korean War, and we respected it. Some of our family members, not the direct kids or his, you know, my mother, but some, my son went, and a lot of the other families went, and they met our family. And we keep in contact with a little bit of email that, you know, we're fortunate to have over there. So I feel blessed that I can still keep a little contact with what's going on the island.
What's been the discussion among Cuban-Americans, Cubans who are in San Diego about this trip and about the rapprochement between the U.S. and Cuba right now?
I think about 50% are relieved that something happened. Something is better than nothing, you know. And the other 50% still feel very strong that, and that's my opinion as well, the people were promised internet. They need food. They don't need internet. tourism is easier to go to Cuba. Now there's actually flights being arranged to leave. Americans will be flying down there, going to, you know, bigger, better hotels are going to be built. But my opinion, my family in Cuba feels is like, what is that going to do for them?
Considering we're like 20 minutes from the U.S.-Mexico border, I'm curious to know how people in San Diego approach Cuban immigrants differently from, say, Mexican immigrants.
Well, I can tell you one thing. This is definitely a West Coast situation, okay? We have a lot more border with Mexico. I think it was in 1964 they passed that law. Any Cuban that touches will have immediate asylum here in the United States.
Wet foot, dry foot.
Yes, right. I think most Latin Americans find that very unfair because there's other places that are being oppressed as well. And I happen to agree with them that the policy should be the same to everybody. This restaurant sees people from all parts of Latin America, all Hispanic countries. And, you know, this conversation comes up a lot.
Here
in the restaurant. Yeah. And they think it's unfair. I've had Cubans that have come through Texas, and they've come through Arizona and in San Diego. And we actually helped interpret the law a little bit because they're sometimes incarcerated for up to 6 months. Until someone says, excuse me, there's a law here, and you're holding this guy here. And that has happened many, many, many times. Now, on the East Coast, that doesn't happen at all.
And that's because the law is known there.
I think there's a large lobby of Cubans that would probably, if someone's being incarcerated, they would bring it out. Where here, they might not be as many. San Diego doesn't have a lot of Cubans. You know? You won't be able to go to one community in San Diego and say, you'll find a lot of Cubans. They're all over.
So San Diego has lots of very tiny little Havanas, micro Havanas.
You could say that. if you consider households.
Daniel Mera is the owner of Andres Restaurant, an unofficial gathering spot for Cubans in San Diego. He was speaking there with the world's own Marco Werman. Coming up, the latest news headlines from Brussels. And also, do terror attacks on Western cities really get more media coverage than those in the Middle East or Asia? That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Obama wraps up his historic trip to Cuba today. So does anyone need TV and Radio Martí out of Miami anymore?
Don't be confused by people shaking hands. That doesn't mean that the Cuban people has any freedom.
Radio Martí and the last remnants of the Cold War. That's coming up here on The World.
Support for this podcast comes from Wonder Capital. What if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time? You can. Introducing Wonder Capital, the leading online investment platform where individuals can invest in large-scale solar projects across the U.S. Earn up to 11% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Join thousands who are already investing. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/theworld. That's Wonder with a U. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Airports around the globe, including here in the U.S., are on high alert following the attacks in Brussels today. Two explosions rocked the departure area of the city's international airport. Another blast hit a subway station in the Belgian capital. Dozens of people were killed in what authorities say were coordinated terror attacks, and ISIS has claimed responsibility. Earlier, I asked Politico's James Panicki in Brussels for an update.
There is still a lot that is not known about what did happen. What we know is that the death toll has climbed to 34. There have been a number of people killed in both the airport attack, which involved two bombs going off, and also a metro train attack, which hit a station called Malbec, right in the European Quarter, in which 20 people are believed to have died, up to 170 injured. The metro lines 1 and 5 that go through this station are extremely popular lines, and so they're always full of people, crammed with people at that time of the morning. And so it was an utterly devastating attack, and one which is obviously affected all of us who work in this part of Brussels, just because it is a station that we use day after day after day. And it really brings home to us the fact that this happened so close to us, to where we work and to where we live.
So is Brussels basically shut down? I mean, are people walking around the streets, or is it kind of locked up right now?
It is locked up at the moment, but there are indications that it's going to get back to normal. Now, the streets are very much deserted at the moment. There's a very eerie atmosphere, but some of the stations have now reopened, which means that a lot of the commuters heading home for the day will be able to do so. But I think it will take a few more days for the city to get back to normal.
How significant is it to Belgians that these attacks this morning happened while security was on high alert?
Look, I think it is very significant. In many ways, there was a moment of euphoria just 3 or 4 days ago when the suspect Salah Adeslam, a terrorism suspect who was alleged to have been involved in the Paris attacks, when he was arrested. This came after many weeks of uncertainty as to his whereabouts and also a lot of criticism which has been levelled against the Belgian authorities over their inability to find him. So there was a feeling of elation, and I think a lot of people felt that in a way they could relax, that this level of alert in a way was not entirely justified. Well, that view has been shattered by these attacks. I think in many ways Belgians hadn't expected this. And it really came as a shock. And I think the city is really still reeling from the implications of these attacks.
James, is this beginning to feel like the new normal for Brussels? Airports closing down, metro, and sort of a general heightened concern?
I think it is, because we are now used to being surrounded, for example, by military. There are soldiers all over the place with very large weapons with them. You know, I take my children to school every day and we're surrounded by these images. They no longer notice these things, and in a way, I don't either. I think this tension and this, in a way, this fear that we're dealing with is sadly the new normal. Whether or not this will change in the near future, well, I doubt it, to be quite honest. But it is something that we're all grappling with and that we all need to come to terms with in our own way.
James Panicki is a reporter for Politico in Brussels. The World's Jeb Sharp was in Belgium's capital twice in recent months. She reported on the security situation there following the Paris attacks in November, which involved a number of suspects from Brussels. She also spoke to refugees from the Middle East who are trying to start new lives in Belgium. Jeb, were you able to check in with some of the people you met while there? And what did they have to say today?
I did. It's been a stream of texts and emails and phone calls, and people are devastated. Their voices are grim. I just had an email saying, we knew it would come and it still feels surreal. I'm sure there's also a sense of defiance, knowing what I know about Brussels, and a little bit this feeling of claustrophobia, because everything shuts down when you're in one of these security alerts, so you can't really move. I've talked to the head of the Red Cross shelter in downtown Brussels, and he, of course, is very concerned. He says many people, refugees, come to Brussels for appointments during the day from far-flung refugee shelters, so a lot of them will have been trapped in the city. And as this guy said, you don't want to be a refugee wandering the streets tonight looking like you're from the Middle East.
Already, at least on social media, there are fingers pointing, immigrants are being blamed. What's the danger here?
I think we know that there's often a backlash after terrorist incidents like this, but I think there's also the fear of backlash. I met a Syrian immigrant who runs a pastry shop in the beautiful old heart of Brussels, and when I was there in November, he said he was going to change the sign on his shop, which said Syrian pâtisserie, to Mediterranean pâtisserie, because he felt that people might equate Syria with ISIS and that he would be under threat.
Jeb, last time you were in Brussels, you visited the district of Molenbeek, which we hear a lot about. I know it's one of the suburbs of Brussels where two of the Paris bombers lived. Any sense how that neighborhood may be dealing with this news today?
Well, I imagine there's a huge police presence, and I imagine people are nervous. And I know that not only does that neighborhood have a serious terrorism and extremism and recruiting problem, it also has a bunch of people living there who feel really stigmatized. So it's a very interesting mix. I was at a vigil back in November where many, many townspeople came out with candles and signs to say, look, we're not all terrorists. It's a tough situation there.
How have Brussels and Belgium at large been changed by the attacks in Paris and now these awful attacks today?
That's a really interesting question, Carol. And of course, in these situations, we tend to talk about a new normal and readjusting to a new sense of threat and perhaps new ways of living and security precautions. But it's also that in Brussels, on my couple of visits there, I've realized that the wars in the Middle East, the numbers of refugees coming west, the threat of terrorist attack, it's just laced through conversations and realities. So I was doing a story about an education program for refugees at the Free University. But part of the thinking on the part of university administrators is, let's get these people studying so there's no risk of them radicalizing. So you sort of see how the themes crop up. And in another conversation with a volunteer family who hosts refugees, the father said, you know, I love doing this and I love meeting these families, but if they don't get asylum and they go back to Afghanistan, I just hope they'll think well of us and not think of us as enemies. So this kind of sense all the time of, you know, we're in something that doesn't feel quite stable and we should do everything we can to create goodwill and connections.
What's left the biggest impression on you from your trips to Belgium?
It's just such an interesting place at such an interesting time. And I think it's just a microcosm of so many of the values and arguments and issues that we're all grappling with today in one very small place. I find it fascinating.
The World's Jeb Sharp, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Carol.
On a day like today, covering the news means we talk a lot about violence and its aftermath. But there's a hard-to-describe feeling you get when you hear about a bomb going off in a place you know. Jeb's written an essay about that, and you can read it at facebook.com/PRI the world. And while you're there, you can read some of her stories from her time in Brussels. Let's quickly turn now to Thomas Hegghammer. He's a specialist in Islamic militancy at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment. Hegghammer has been looking at potential links between today's attacks in Brussels and the Paris attacks last November.
If this attack is somehow linked to the Paris attacks, if the same kind of networks were involved, then this represents a potentially very significant development in that the same network was able to strike big twice, which is unusual in the terrorism world. But of course, I have to stress that we don't know for sure whether we are indeed dealing with the same network. But of course, either way, Belgium is facing a very serious terrorism situation.
Brussels is a city that was on high alert. What seems to be missing, or what are Belgian security people unable to keep track of at this point?
Well, Belgian services, as well as several other services in Europe, are overwhelmed by the sheer amount of activity, suspicious activity by radical groups. And they only have so many resources at their disposal to monitor and intervene against these networks. So they cannot watch everything, and there's a lot going on. So there will always be people who can go under the radar. And what's happened, of course, in the past 3, 4, 5 years is that, you know, the number of people of concern has increased significantly. And nobody knows this better than the Belgians themselves. I want to stress that Belgian intelligence services have long been the first to admit that they're facing a big problem.
Finally, if we look back on the last year, we've had Charlie Hebdo, the Bataclan attacks, and now this. Where do we go from here?
Well, unfortunately, I think we can expect more attacks in the years ahead because there are so many individuals in Europe who have a clear intention to carry out violent attacks, and there are so many IS sympathizers, there are so many returnees from Syria, and it's very resource-intensive to kind of monitor all of these individuals and to prevent every attack. I would expect to see more attacks like this in the years ahead, unfortunately.
Thomas Hegghammer is Senior Research Fellow at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment and a specialist in Islamist militancy. Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Now back to President Obama's trip to Cuba. Coverage of the historic visit is everywhere this week, including on radio and TV Martí, the U.S. government operation that delivers news back to Cuba from studios in Miami. The broadcast started under President Reagan, back when the Cold War was still on. Now with President Obama's opening to Cuba well underway, some argue the Martís have become an expensive Cold War relic. The World's Jason Margolis got a tour of the newsroom in Miami and sent this report.
And here you have journalists at work on all three of our platforms.
On first impression, radio and TV Martí looks and feels like pretty much any other newsroom.
You're going to see a number of our radio studios.
Emilio Vasquez shows me around. We watch two radio broadcasters behind a thick pane of glass.
We have a morning show known as El Revoltillo, which is like an on-air swap market type of show where people call in and offer different products and services for sale on island.
But here's what's very different about this call-in show. It's illegal for its listeners to call in, or even to listen, that is, if they even can. The Cuban government tries to jam broadcast signals coming from Florida. Vasquez says they're always trying to stay one step ahead.
We have various methods of transmission. We have medium-wave transmission on AM frequency. We have our short-wave transmissions.
Those change frequencies throughout the course of the day. Vasquez starts to tell me some other tricks when we run into his boss, Malule Gonzalez.
Malule Gonzalez.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Nice. So sorry, we're running a bit late.
That's okay.
On our way up to her office, we stop for shots of hyper-potent Cuban coffees. Gonzalez is the director of the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, the official name of radio and TV Martí. She tells me more about how their TV content gets out in Cuba. On the island, vendors on the street sell what's called el paquete, thumb drives or DVDs with movies, music, or videos.
We have our own paquete. We create our own distribution of DVDs.
So you have your ways.
We have our ways, yeah. We have more ways than that one, but there are many things that you don't reveal because they monitor everything that we do or say. So I'm not going to give them all. It's just like the magician. He never reveals the tricks, no?
They're currently handing out about 16,000 paquetes a month in Cuba. Gonzalez is confident their shows are being seen, but she has no way to prove it. Nobody does. There aren't Nielsen ratings. Past surveys suggest the audience for the Martís is quite small, perhaps as low as 2% of the island. But anecdotal evidence suggests otherwise. Uva de Aragon is a retired professor who was also a commentator for 15 years on Radio Martí. She told me about a time she got in a cab in Havana in the late 90s.
This taxi driver was amazing because he heard me talk to my sister, and he said, "Excuse me that I ask you, but do you talk in a radio show?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You talk in Radio Martí?" And I say, "Yes." He says, "Your name, Uva de Aragon?" It was my second day in Havana after 40 years.
That was a while ago, though. It's a much different world in Cuba today, says Eduardo Gamara with Florida International University.
Cuba is now able to access the internet more freely than it did just a year ago. Telecommunications is penetrating Cuba much more quickly than people expected. But it's also true that Cubans still don't have free access to global information.
In fact, by some estimates, only 5% of Cubans actually have access to the internet. Still, critics question if Cubans are getting the best information from the Martís. They call the programming one-dimensional, conservative, a mouthpiece of American policy. Gamara says he's staunchly disagreed with many editorials broadcast by the Martís.
But I think the criticism of them that because they're conservative, they're not good journalists, doesn't follow. They still have some value. I think it has an expiration date, though.
When that expiration date should be is the big question. With a thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations, some say the time is now. A Democratic congresswoman introduced a bill to end the Martís. It's called the Stop Wasting Taxpayer Money on Cuba Broadcasting Act. The Martís cost U.S. taxpayers $27 million a year. President Obama wants to turn the Martís into an independent nonprofit, but still funded by the government. Many conservatives say that would weaken the government's commitment. They say the Martís still provide an invaluable service exposing human rights abuses in Cuba. Malule Gonzalez says her operation is more important than ever, even with President Obama on the island today.
Don't be confused by people shaking hands. That doesn't mean that the Cuban people has any freedom.
But she says she hopes the day will come when Radio and TV Martí are no longer needed. And when that happens, she'll be happy to shut things down.
So if we're out of a job, well, then I'll call you and send my resume. But out of a job, but celebrating.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Miami.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. The attacks in Brussels are our main story today. Chances are they're also dominating your social media feeds. But why do we give so much attention to terrorist attacks in Belgium and not so much to similar attacks in, say, Turkey or Kenya? Zeynep Tufekci thinks a lot about questions like that. She's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, focusing on the intersection of media and society. And she says social media has a big impact on which stories we focus on and which ones we don't.
If you're a news junkie, or if you're somebody who's actually concerned with many places in the world, you can go and find people who will tell you about it. I had friends in Kenya. I was there a couple years ago for one visit, and I made some friends. I started following on Twitter. I befriended a few on Facebook. And when something happened in Kenya, there was a bombing, and another terrorist attack in Kenya, I heard a lot about it from them, even though it wasn't covered as much in mass media. On the other hand, if you don't want to hear much about news from places that are far from you or is not of interest to you, there's never been a better time to tune it all out because there's endless amount of information and entertainment you can consume without ever encountering hard news. You could be completely isolated from the news. There's a polarization between the people who are using social media to enrich the amount of news they get and the people who are using it to create a bubble for themselves.
So for social media users, there's kind of a self-curation that goes on. And
absolutely. What social media brings to the table is both a more varied option. So if you do want to self-curate into a news-heavy world, you can do that. But it also brings in these algorithms that create a feedback cycle with whatever path you're on. So if you're on a path that is trying to isolate yourself from news and you don't engage much and you don't have too many friends that do, what social media like Facebook's newsfeed algorithm tends to do is it reinforces that. You already don't want to see it. You already don't have too many friends interested in news. And then the algorithm starts showing you even less. So what might have otherwise sneaked through from a few of your friends is also suppressed. So this algorithm can complete the bubble by pushing you into things that it thinks that you will click on more.
Let's talk about how the whole algorithm thing affected coverage of Ferguson.
The Ferguson protests of August 2014 were a really instructive moment on the role of algorithms in news coverage. Twitter at the time was not algorithmically regulated, which meant that whatever people posted, we just saw it. Facebook was algorithmically regulated through its Facebook news feed. And what happened is, even though my friends were talking about the Ferguson news, even as it was happening, Facebook's algorithm wasn't showing it to me, probably because my friends couldn't like the news because Facebook's news feed has that ubiquitous like button you're supposed to click on like. And since the news wasn't very likable, people were not clicking on like, which meant the algorithm wasn't showing it to people, which meant even fewer people were clicking on like because they weren't even seeing it or commenting on it. Whereas on Twitter, which was at the time algorithmically unregulated, it was this avalanche of discussion and news about what was going on. And mass media, too, was fairly ignoring the situation until about 3 million tweets were sent on Twitter. And people were bugging journalists saying, look, something major, something newsworthy is going on. And only after that did it break through. So it was this really interesting and, to be honest, troubling window into a world in which the algorithm's feedback cycle is suppressing one kind of news. At the time, Facebook's algorithm was highlighting the ice bucket challenge, which was people donating to ALS by dumping buckets of ice water on their head and donating money, which is a good thing, of course. But it was so likable that it was sucking all the oxygen out of the news feed.
In the case of Ferguson, if Twitter had had its own algorithm at the time, would that story have played out in a different way?
That's a great question, especially if Twitter had an algorithm like Facebook in which more like stories made it and the less like ones kind of disappeared. It may never have seen the light of day. So maybe that's the danger, is that we'll go back to this world where the advertiser happy part of the medium dominates. And what I fear is, instead of living up to the ethics, we're kind of going back into unbundling everything and every story trying to survive on its own. And some important stories are making it out there, but sometimes there are stories, for example, the Flint, Michigan lead water crisis was covered widely, apparently, in their local news. They kept trying to get more traction on this emergent concern, and it went nowhere for a long time, which means children were lead poisoned for much longer than they should have been. So the question is, how do we pick those important stories that are not as lighthearted and nice to click on as What Color is the Dress? And I think with the self-curation and algorithmic effects, I think people are trying to figure out how to bring those important stories to the front, which sometimes means you have to learn new media tactics. You can't just trust that your feed is going to bring the important stories to you if you don't take some care to try to find more reliable sources of information. It's like there's this whole new literacy and whole new world of opportunity to be better informed, but you have to put the effort into it. You can't just assume that mass media is going to do it for you. And maybe that's better because mass media was never perfect either.
Zeynep Tufekci teaches about society and social media at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Thanks, Zeynep.
Thank you.
Some of you may know that when I'm not hosting the show, I follow political cartoons from around the world. This morning, I woke up to dozens of cartoons responding to the attacks in Brussels. Artists from Bulgaria to South Africa are weighing in. I put together a sample of those cartoons, and you can see them over at PRI.org. We close today's program with a song. It's by Israeli singer-songwriter Aidan Re'echel. His opening verse contains these lines: "The familiar and the known, the taken for granted, is folded in the chambers of my heart, refuses to surrender to the pain." Poignant words for today and always. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
מסרב להיכנע לכאב משבוע לשבוע, ציפייה לדבר האמיתי שיפתח את הדלתות הנעולות, ייכנס ויעטוף אותי חזק. או היד החמה, או היחד בדממה, כבר שנים שלא עבר כאן מישהו בסביבה, לצבוע קירות ישנים. או היד החמה.
PRI, Public Radio International.